Welcome back and welcome to this session. And in this session, we're going to be looking at what I consider to be the heart of the matter, what EWCs, what European Work Councils are totally about, information and consultation, and especially information and consultation in exceptional circumstances. Now, of course, some of you watching this will have agreements, and agreements will say different things. But, you know, I can't and we can't in this address the differentials between all of the different agreements. So that's why we're concentrating on the subsidiary requirements, the baseline from which all agreements grow out and are measured against. So, as I said in the last session, the essence, the heart of the 2009 EWC directive is an obligation that places on management to inform and consult European Works Councils. And that's at least annually, about the general state of the business. And in exceptional circumstances, which generally mean potential decisions which affect employees and which adversely affect employees, such as collective redundancies, closures, transfer of undertakings, or perhaps major work reorganizations. Now, I want to make an important point here, okay, which is that the obligation to inform is placed on management. And in all circumstances, it is management which initiates the process. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in the legislation to suggest that an EWC has the right of initiative, a right to demand meetings based on what it thinks might be happening. I have seen some suggestions from EWCs that where they think, based on internet Googling, that something may be afoot, that they are entitled to commission experts to investigate and to report back to the EWC. There is no such provision in the directive. The directive is clear and concise. The obligation to initiate processes rests with management. And indeed, this was underscored by the decision of the Central Arbitration Committee in the UK in the Oracle decision, and we'll be coming back to that a little bit later in this particular presentation. Now, it's also important to keep in mind the limitations of what the EWC information and consultation process is about. There are times that EWCs, quite frankly, get carried away with themselves and think that they have a role beyond what the legislation gives them. They don't. They're not co-determination bodies. They're not negotiating bodies. They're not even bodies consultation with a view to reaching an agreement. At the end of the day, they can offer an opinion on the information provided to them by management, nothing more. And it's important that, as I said in the last session, that you lay down and be clear and precise about the ground rules from the get-go. No mission creep. So, interestingly, the directive doesn't actually define information. What it defines, what it sets out, is a process or an obligation on management to provide information. But it has nothing to say about the nature of the information to be provided. So let's look at that in a little bit more detail. Information means the transition of data by the employer to enable them to acquaint themselves with the subject matter, to examine it. It should be given in such time, such fashion, such content, as is appropriate to enable the employees to undertake an in-depth assessment of the possible impact and where appropriate to prepare for consultations. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot to understand there. Yeah. And what we as management think those words mean, EWC members and their outside advisors, whether unions or paid for consultants, may well do and do take a different perspective. But let me tell you what I think, what we in Berg think this language means. Data. There's no list of what data is to be provided. It simply says to have such content as is appropriate. Who decides on that? How do we know that the data that we're prepared to provide as management is appropriate? Who's entitled to tell us that the data we have provided is not appropriate? The data, as I've said in the previous session, the data should be transnational, not national. There's no requirement, in my view, to provide granular, detailed national information. So, you know, the thing is this, the granular information is always national. That's where the detail is. When we come to talk to a Beliebtrag, coming down to Paris, a works council or a union grouping in Italy, that's where we provide the detailed granular information. All we can do, and in my view, all we are supposed to do and all we are entitled to do and all that is appropriate to do at European level is to provide headline European level figures. And we don't have to provide all the data, just data that is appropriate to allow for an in-depth assessment. And we'll come back to what an in-depth assessment means in a few minutes. So as I say, who decides on these matters? Who decides what is appropriate? This is and always will be contested territory. Oh, let me jump a little. That was the definition in the actual body of the directive. So let me jump a little to the subsidiary requirements which are in an appendix to the directive. And here's what we find. The information and consultation meeting shall take place as soon as possible on the basis of a report to be drawn up by central management or any other appropriate level of management, of the community scale, and blah, blah, on which an opinion may be offered at the end of the meeting or within a reasonable time. So management has to prepare a report. That report obviously has to be based on the data that is appropriate to the issue under consideration. The data is to allow the EWC to undertake an in-depth assessment. And when we're thinking about all of this as well, we need to keep in mind that what we're talking about when we're dealing with the European Works Council is a multinational, multilingual, multicultural, multi-tradition in terms of labor relations. And language is an issue. We're not dealing with a monolingual German Works Council or French Comité d'Entreprise or monolingual trade union grouping in the UK or Sweden. We are dealing with a very diverse group of people. More than that, we may well be dealing with winners and losers within the group. Because, for instance, let's say we were closing or downsizing or an operation in France or Spain and transferring production or operations to Hungary or Poland or Romania. Obviously the French and the Spanish are going to be less than gruntled. Actually, they're going to be disgruntled. But the Romanians or the Poles or the Hungarians are going to sit there and say, we're not going to go home and say we turned down these jobs in solidarity with our French colleagues. So, these are difficult and complex issues that we need to keep in mind. Oh, by the way, let me jump forward a little bit and say could become even more complex with Brexit as companies decide to transfer functions out of the UK and back into the European Union. That could be a difficult issue. We come back to all of that when we talk about EWCs and Brexit. Look again at what the subsidiary requirements have to say. A report drawn up by central management on which an opinion may be delivered at the end of the meeting or within a reasonable time thereafter. Look at the words on the page. Not what you want them to be, but as they are. A report drawn up on which an opinion may be delivered. So it seems to me a valid interpretation of the subsidiary requirements is that management draws up a report based on appropriate data relevant to the decision under consideration, and at the end of the meeting, at the end of the meeting, DWC offers an opinion on their report. Right? Now, they may say the report was inadequate, that it didn't deal with the facts fully, that, you know, it fell short of their expectations. You know? But that's an opinion. That's an opinion. Look at the words. Look at the words. You know? Now, DWC may be unhappy with the decision and may believe that is entitled to further information. But, you know, management's not entitled to answer all and every question from the EWC. Because EWCs will keep asking questions forever and a day. You know, that's just in their nature. Right? So what information you do provide is a judgment call and may well be disputed. We may, you know, probably will be disputed. So let's go back now to what the directive says. You know, data, acquaint themselves with, to undertake an in-depth assessment. Now, what do we mean by an in-depth assessment? Again, look at the words carefully. Okay? In-depth assessment of the possible impact. Not an in-depth assessment of the proposed decision, but an in-depth assessment of the possible impact of the proposed decision. And that's two, they are two very different things, in my opinion. And in the opinion of many of the management colleagues that I work with on these issues. Yeah. The EWC, in this language, isn't being invited to undertake an in-depth assessment of the decision per se. It's been asked to undertake an in-depth assessment of the possible impact of the decision, and they are two very different things. Yeah. We work with the language of the directive as we find it. Now what EWC or EWC experts would wish it to be. And, you know, if you often listen to EWCs and their experts, they will say that this is what the directive should be. Okay? But they realize it's not what it is. Let me give you, tell you a story. I was at a meeting in Brussels some time ago where a particular project was being considered by the European Commission. Project never went anywhere. But the union representatives at the meeting were very clear about what they saw as the deficiencies in the directive, i.e., they knew and they admitted and they accept, which is why they're looking for changes in the directive at the moment, because they know the directive is not what they say it is. You read the words on the page as opposed to what the unions and the EWCs and their experts would like those words to be, because they're not what they would like them to be. They are as they are. Right? So the in-depth assessment relates to the possible impact of the proposed decision, not the decision itself. That's a management prerogative, in my view. You know, EWC has no delaying powers, no veto powers. No. In my view, EWC does not need to be involved before the decision is taken. The decision needs to be taken in principle. And what the EWC then becomes involved around the potential impact of that decision. Which, by the way, you know, let's not fool ourselves here. Right? The impact of any decision can itself be complicated. Can we say, you know, it's not necessarily, yeah, we're just going to lose 300 jobs or 400 jobs or whatever, or 2,000 jobs in the example we gave in the last module. What happens to those who are left? What happens to the organizational structures? You know, these are not easy issues. Not easy issues as we think about them. No. What EWCs and their experts quite often want management to do, right, is to justify the decision that they are proposing and to provide the information that justifies the decision, i.e. show us your workings which led you to these conclusions. Right? Show us the data that brought you to this particular point. I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that that's what the language in the directive calls for or requires. Management makes a decision. EWCs are not a shadow management. They're not there to second guess management. They're not some sort of management in waiting. No. Management takes the decision based on whatever rationale that makes sense to management. You know, that's the nature of a market society, that management runs the company on behalf of the key stakeholder, which is the shareholders, which is not to say that workers are not a key stakeholder, but they're not the decision-making stakeholder. Management is on behalf of the decision-making stakeholder, which is the share owners. That's the nature of the society in which we live. EWCs are not a shadow management. We don't have to justify decisions to them. We simply have to explain decisions to them. And we have to outline what the impact or the potential impact of those decisions will be in the future as we implement them, as they get rolled out. So look again, look again at the wording that we find in the directive. Information will be given at such time, in some fashion, and with such content to enable employee representatives to undertake an in-depth assessment of the impact. Right? Now, the reasonable interpretation of these words, in my view, the only interpretation of these words, is that the purpose of the EWC, the function of the EWC, is to assess the information provided by management. Now, it may find this information inadequate. It may ask management for additional information. It can pose questions. And all of that is reasonable. And insofar as management can respond to those requests for additional information or can respond to questions, well, it seems to me reasonable that management should do so. That's what a dialogue and an exchange of views is about. Hey, I didn't quite understand what you said to me. Could you explain that a little bit more? That's reasonable. But there is nothing in the wording of the directive to support the idea that the EWC is entitled to go off and conduct independent information searches of its own, still less to commission experts to do so on its behalf. Still less, The EWC is not a proactive body. It is a reactive body. It reacts to the information provided to it by management. And it has no authority to be found within the directive to allow it to go off and do independent searches of its own, or to have experts do independent searches on its behalf, however much experts might like to think that that right somehow or other exists, is embodied in the directive. It isn't. It's just not there. So the information and consultation takes place on the basis of the information provided by management. That is the inherent logic of the directive. Experts, and this brings me to experts. Under the subsidiary requirements, the EWC is entitled to be assisted by an expert of its choice. Now, unlike experts assisting special negotiating bodies, experts assisting European Works Councils are not given an explicit right to attend meetings between the management and the EWC. In my view, if the legislators wanted to give them that right, they would have written it into the legislation like they did for experts and SMBs. In our view, the role of the expert is restricted to assisting the EWC assessing the information provided by management. We don't believe, as already said, that the EWC has the right to commission ECMAS to undertake any sort of independent analysis or audit, much and all, as we have seen, and I have seen in even in recent weeks, quotations from experts, you know, offering to undertake this. You know, we will provide a team of three experts who will take us 15 days to do this. You know, there is no such right in the legislation. The right of experts is to assist the EWC to undertake an in-depth assessment, and that in-depth assessment is restricted to analysing and understanding the information provided by a management, asking questions, certainly, and the experts can advise the EWC to ask additional questions, but there's no role for experts or for the EWCs to go off and do independent assessment. Let me make a further point. The expert is there to assist the EWC. They have no right to engage directly with management or to request information from management. They are there to advise the EWC. If the EWC wants more information from management, the EWC asks. That's not a job they should or can delegate to an expert. So we need to be clear, ground rules from the get-go. If there's an expert involved, the expert works to and through the EWC. There is no involvement between the expert and management. And that's a rigid line that needs to be drawn from the get-go. Who are these experts? You know, what's, you know, where did this idea of that? You see, look, think of it this way. Okay, I can understand. I can understand in an SMB, you bring together a group of people from a multilingual, multicultural background, never met one another before, and they're there to negotiate an agreement to set up a European Works Council. For the most part, they have no idea what they're doing. So the idea of somebody coming in who does know what they're doing and can help them and guide them and shape them to reach an agreement makes perfect sense, right? Perfect sense. But when we get to a European Works Council, what we're talking about is information and consultation about a company that these people work for. And the concept, the idea, is that they're supposed to know about the company they work for. They're supposed to know about what the company they work for is doing, what its issues are, what its problems are. Right? Why should they need an expert to come in and tell them about their own company? They shouldn't. No. Now, everybody in this business, and I've been in this business of European Works Council since the early 1990s, before the first directive was even adopted. Right? And everybody in this business knows that the word expert was code for trade union official. Right? The expert was going to be a trade union official coming in on behalf of the European Trade Union Federation to coordinate the European Works Council, which was perceived at that time to would be full of trade union members. But of course, that's not the way it turned out, as we discussed, because trade union density has dropped enormously across Europe. And for the most part, most European Works Councils don't have that many trade union members on them anyway. But the expert was understood to be a trade union official, coordinating, liaising, you know, back with the European Federation. However, and that was the way it was between 1996 and sort of the late, until about 2011, 2012. But with the addition of the words in-depth assessment in the 2009 revised directive, experts à la française, you know, the type of experts that have been assisting French Comité d'Entreprise for years to assess whether or not management was telling them the truth about the figures so that they got their proper profit share, saw a business opportunity and they could export their model. We'll audit the management on your behalf. You know, we'll double check the information they provide you with. Business opportunity, I don't blame anybody for trying to seize a business opportunity, nothing wrong with that. But, you know, that's not what the directive says. Yeah. Now it's been suggested that these experts who sort of, we lauded the information given to you by management. Now we can go further. We can help you develop a counter strategy to that proposed by management. Now, quite often in difficult and complex restructuring operations, there are several actors on the employee representation side. There's the European Works Council, there may be trade unions, local works councils, and so on. Right? And if a local works council, depending on the legislation in question, or a trade union body wants to develop a counter strategy to that be proposed by management, well, then they're entitled to do that within the framework of national law. Or if that's what the trade union wants to do, well, then the trade union is entitled to go and do that. But that is not the role of the European Works Council as provided for in the legislation. So we need to be careful about drawing lines of demarcation. And don't let the European Works Council have, in other words, you know, hey, you know what? We need to develop a counter strategy. You know, these experts who might do that cost a lot of money. So let's run that through the European Works Council because then management will pay for it. Yeah, draw lines of demarcation. If the trade unions want to involve experts to develop counter strategies, let the trade unions pay for that. Management shouldn't have to do so. Shouldn't have to do so. But that's what's been attempted here with mission creep on behalf of experts. You know, management funding experts to develop counter strategies to that been developed by management itself. So be careful of mission creep by experts. So back to the wording. Information should be given at such time in such fashion and with such content as are appropriate for value. When should the EWC be given the information? Now, we need to keep two things in mind. First of all, is the decision of the UK CAC and Oracle. So come on to that in a moment. And secondly, you know, how do we manage business communication in the internet age? We're not back in the early 1990s. We are where we are today, you know. And, you know, I'm doing this session with you because we can't meet live in situs. You know? We're running EWC meetings virtually as of the moment. Right? So we have to understand that things change and we need to anticipate and work with those changes and mold them and shape them in our best interest. Now, Oracle is a seminal decision. Oracle operates under the subsidiary requirements in the UK. And I'm not going to go into the details of it. Of the case, the issue in question. They're there on the public record. If you want to go and read them, just Google, you know, Central Arbitration Committee UK Oracle and the decision will come up. It's not bedtime reading, I can assure you. You know, it's not a Da Vinci Code. But what basically the takeaway from the Oracle decision in the UK is this. When management believes that exceptional circumstances, whatever they might be, then they inform the select committee. Then the select committee may request an information and consultation meeting. And by the way, one meeting. It refers to one meeting, not meetings. You know, there's no series of meetings. There's not an information meeting. There's not a consultation meeting and so on. There is one information and consultation meeting. Management then provides appropriate information to the select committee, stroke EWC, to allow for an in-depth assessment. We've talked about what that might or might not mean. The information and consultation, one meeting, then takes place. At the end of the meeting or shortly thereafter, the EWC may offer an opinion. Management responds to the opinion, and that response closes the information and consultation process. Now, there's nothing in the directive and there's no guidance as to how exactly and when the information is to be provided. Now, you know, come back to my previous point. The directive was written in the pre-information page when information had to be sent physically through the post or by fax. You know, I remember the days well. You know, I remember the days well. And that took time. But also, of course, we have the issue of language and interpretation and so on. So quite often, management would only present the information in exceptional circumstances at the meeting, where it could be interpreted, translated, and put in context. You know? But things have changed. You know, we've moved on. We need to understand that, in my view. You know? How do we normally send business information nowadays? We send it electronically, and the EWC should be no differently. You know? And as I've already said, at the moment, you know, and for the foreseeable future, we're going to be meeting electronically, virtually. You know? The idea that there's going to be big EWC meetings anytime soon, and certainly before the end of next year, even if into 2022, seems to me to be magical thinking. So we need to be reasonable. You know, I've always said to those I work with, ask yourself the question, if you appear before a court or a tribunal, do you appear to be a reasonable person acting reasonably, all things considered in the circumstances? So it seems to me an appropriate way of working is that once a date is fixed, management prepares a report, and we have to be the judges of what we consider to be the appropriate content of that report, right? For the select committee or the full X days, whatever number of days, you know, in advance of the meeting. The EWC assesses that report with the help of the expert if needed. And I'm assuming, as I say, in the bottom bullet point there, that all of this stuff is now being done virtually, which makes things different from when you had to have physical meetings to do things. You know? Once the EWC has the report, it seems to me appropriate and you know, reasonable that they may come back with supplementary questions in advance of the meeting. If we can answer those questions in advance of the meeting, we should do so. Right? If they ask for information we consider inappropriate or beyond the remit, then we should say that as well. Just because the EWC asks for information doesn't mean we have to give it. It has to be appropriate, and we have to be the judges of that from a management perspective. Brings us to the meeting itself. Consultation is described in the directive as follows. There you have it. Let's look at the key. Establishment of a dialogue and exchange of views. As I said previously, you know, that's what most Irish people would do on a Friday night down in the local pub. We establish dialogue and we exchange views, you know. At the appropriate level of management, at such time and in such fashion and such content, you know, to offer an opinion on the basis of the information provided about the proposed measure. Right? Note again, on the basis of the information provided, not the information that the EWC has commissioned an expert to go off and dig up, you know, by reading Standard and Poor reports on the company or analyst comments or such thing, and then try to charge management, you know, 20 odd grand for cutting and pasting a Standard and Poor analyst comment. Without prejudice to the responsibility of management and within a reasonable time. So in other words, my view is that the responsibility of management is to make the decision. And as we've seen previously, the purpose of the EWC is to comment on the potential impact of that decision, not on the decision itself. Of course, as I said at the start, and what we're offering in these sessions is what we understand to be a reasonable management interpretation of the legislation. And I've made it clear on a number of occasions that, you know, these interpretations are contested. But we believe these interpretations to be a reasonable interpretation. And quite frankly, most of the court cases that we've been involved in, when we've used this analysis and presented these analysis to the court, more often than not, the court has come down on the side of management. So we know we're not straying off into sort of some unexplored territory. We're working off the basis of what's already happened and decisions that courts have already made. Dialogue, information provided about the proposed measure. It's not consultation with a view to reaching an agreement, as for instance we find in the Collective Redundancy Directive. It is simply the offering of an opinion. Now, yeah, an opinion is an opinion. I looked it up. The Cambridge Dictionary defines opinion as a thought or belief about something or someone. That's all an opinion is, a thought or a belief. Nothing more than that. No. So in our view, consultation as provided for in the directive consists of a conversation between management and the EWC on the basis of the information provided by management and not on any other basis. And at the end of the process, the EWC can offer an opinion. There is nothing in the legislation which says that the EWC has to be satisfied or convinced, you know, about anything that management says. They can disagree profoundly with anything management has said, and they can express an opinion to that effect. But that's the sum total of what it can do. Nothing more, nothing less. I draw your attention back to the words I had on the bottom of another slide. Beware of mission creep. There is no obligation on the EWC to offer an opinion. It doesn't have to do so. It may not want to do so. For instance, go back to a situation we talked about previously where production has been transferred from Spain or Belgium or the Netherlands to Romania or Poland, you know? Spanish or the Belgian would be very unhappy about what's happening. The Romanians would be very happy at what's happening. There are new jobs coming to their homeland. You know? Sometimes it's impossible for an EWC to formulate coherently, internally, an opinion because there are clashing interests within the EWC, which is why there's no obligation on the EWC to offer an opinion because it might never be able to do so. That being the case, as the CAC pointed out in Oracle, there cannot be an obligation on management to wait for an opinion from the EWC, which the EWC has no obligation to actually give in the first place. How can you tell somebody to wait for something that may never happen? Especially when critical business decisions are in play. So therefore, because management doesn't have to wait for the EWC's opinion, there's no restraint, no constraint on management about opening national level information and consultation, concluding that national level information and consultation, and implementing any decisions that come out of it, even if the EWC hasn't given its opinion. The two processes run in parallel, independently of each other. If the EWC wants to offer an opinion that can be taken into account by management, then it needs to do so in a timely fashion. If it wants to play games, it can play games. But its opinion will be of little use in such circumstances. So, if and when the EWC doesn't offer an opinion, then management responds to that opinion and that concludes the process. Now, that's it. End of. Now, thank you very much for your opinion. We've taken what you said on board and here's our comments on what you had to say. The response should be in writing. There's no need for further meetings. This is not consultation with a view to negotiating, with a view to reaching an agreement. It's simply you offered an opinion. Thank you very much for your opinion. Here's our response to your opinion. Nor is there any need to come back to the EWC as the proposed decision has been rolled out, has been implemented. You know, certainly, if you want, as a management, you can keep the EWC informed as to how things proceed. And in any event, you know, exceptional circumstances, decisions will always come up, you know, on the agenda at the next annual meeting and so on. But there's no obligation to report back to the EWC. Once the information and consultation process is over, that's the end of the involvement of the EWC in that particular exceptional circumstance episode. And suggestions to the contrary should be rejected. Brings us back to clear lines, clear-sighted understanding of the role of the EWC from the get-go. So that's obviously, if we were doing this in person, you know, this session would probably take about twice, if not three times as long as questions came up and we looked at issues in a lot more detail, and we explored issues and challenges and so on. But obviously, that's not the way things are at the moment. So that's the way we see things around the core concept of information and consultation in European Works Councils. In our next session, we'll be looking at the rest. You know, what do we do about training? What do we do about reporting back? What do we do about confidentiality? You know, what are the questions that arise around these issues? So what do we do our next session? Have that glass of wine or aperitif. Thanks for watching, and see you next time.